Good morning. This is Cass with the Herald and Review for Decatur, dated March 7th, 2016. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Illinois Hires Lovie Smith as Head Coach. Champaign. The University of Illinois says former NFL coach Lovie Smith will be named the next football coach at the University of Illinois. Smith, who is head coach of the Chicago Bears and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, was announced as coach Monday and replaces Bill Cubitt. Cuba was fired Saturday after one season in charge at Illinois. Smith said in a news release that he did not hesitate to take his first college head coaching job. Smith coached the Buccaneers for 2 years and had an 8-24 overall record. He was fired in January. The defensive-minded Smith also took the Bears to the Super Bowl in 2006, where they lost to the Indianapolis Colts. The Bears fired Smith after the 2012 season. Cubitt was 5-7 as Illinois' interim coach last fall. St. Patrick's preschoolers dive into STEM education early. Decatur, Logan Atwater. Five doesn't miss a whole lot. As he prepared to pit the little sailboat he'd just finished fashioned using a straw against one made by classmate Paul Cunningham Jr., he noticed that both had chosen a piece of aqua pool noodle for their craft and blue construction paper for their sail. "Hey, yours is the same as mine," Logan exclaimed before taking up another straw to blow his creation across the water. "Ha-ha, mine's faster, buddy." To the casual observer, this may have seemed like nothing more than the controlled chaos common to a preschool classroom. But to the more initiated, it looked like St. Patrick's School's new emphasis on STEM education, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math at the earliest level. The activity is all about introducing them to the concepts of sinking and floating, Principal Jan Sweet said. Many times you take things for granted as an adult or even as an older child, but little ones don't know these things. To cover all STEM aspects, teacher Karen Layden's Float Your Boat lesson plan also involved watching a Sesame Street and YouTube videos and sorting objects that sink and float into categories and counting them. Because St. Patrick incorporates religion and art into its STEM education, preschoolers also read the story of Noah's Ark and spend time decorating their boats to make it a true STEM project. Under the supervision of teaching assistant Dawn Schuerman, 8 members of Layden's class had fun counting how many rocks 4-year-old Gabe Randall's aluminum foil boat could hold without sinking. 5-year-old Lane Plummer's craft was similar in size but had no upturned edges to keep the water out and thus sank after the second rock was placed inside. "We talked about differences caused by how boats are shaped," Layden said. "They love this project and would do it every day if they could." Sweet said a $5,000 ADM CARES grant has helped the school buy materials this year for STEM projects, including building and racing model cars last semester and incorporating smaller projects for all grades as part of the school's Mardi Gras celebration February 9th. Asked why her boat floated, Avery Brand, 5, seemed not to understand a visitor's confusion. "It's a sailboat," she said. Logan offered a different answer to the same question. "'Cause it's part of a pool noodle," he said. Dinner bucket in Assumption has food for all. Assumption. There's food for everyone in the dinner bucket. The restaurant, known for its made-from-scratch specials such as fried chicken and bread pudding, never made a dinner it didn't like. And its fare has become so popular that the nearby GSI grain bin factory features an updated weekly menu on the company's computer system. Workers make their choices and then punch 4440 on the GSI phone system, which is an extension created for the dinner bucket. Food deliveries are made every half hour from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. There is no charge for delivery, and the same courtesy is extended to all Assumption customers. The deal gets even better for Meals on Wheels clients on days when their service doesn't operate. The dinner bucket will take them a free meal instead. And preachers in town who know someone is having a rough week will also call in and say, so-and-so is having a real bad time, their car broke down, or something, and we will help them out with a meal, said Diana Barnes, who owns the dinner bucket with her husband Perry. This Norman Rockwell view of small-town life seems almost quaint now, but it was the way Barnes and her husband were raised. They created the dinner bucket 20 years ago, taking over a bakery Diana Barnes' parents, Harold and Phyllis Garner, had started as a retirement gig but quickly grew tired of the punishing hours. Their daughter and son-in-law stepped in and became convinced by the notion that a restaurant might fly. She can remember a GSI worker who had walked in one day at her dad's business and asked if they did sandwiches to go. My dad said, no, but if you go down to the store and get a loaf of bread and bring it back, we'll make you one, she recalls with a smile. He did, and the next day we had four people wanting a sandwich. These days, the narrow but deep restaurant can seat 90 diners with ease, and frequently does, with more people lining up outside to wait for a table. Once inside, there's plenty of eye candy, too, including a collection of more than 240 cookie jars lining the walls. Some are quite bizarre, such as the one featuring the twisted leer of a clown's head, which is unnerving and fascinating at the same time. Some of our elderly customers, when they pass away, they have our name written on the bottom of their cookie jars, and the family brings them up here, explains Diana. It's nice being in a small town. She arrives about 4 a.m. every day to open up the place and run it with a hard-working staff of six women she's come to trust. She likes to reward their efforts with little extras, and this year's treat is taking them on a 5-day Bahamian cruise. Having good employees makes our job so much easier, you know, said Barnes, 56. Her husband works full-time at GSI, but helps out at the restaurant whenever he can. He's a regular fixture Thursday nights when the restaurant is open later for fried chicken and bread pudding buffet menu that pulls customers in from as far as Decatur and Cerro Gordo. I'm more or less a waiter and a talker, said Perry Barnes, 58, and I pass out napkins. My wife says I'm the PR guy. I love to talk. He shoots the breeze and kids around with regulars who have been coming for so long they regard the dinner bucket as an extension of their family dining tables. And you do feel like you're at home, just like eating with a large group of people, says frequent diner Denise Just, who runs the Just bookstore in town with her husband Chris. You have a lot of camaraderie, and the food's good and the prices are good. Perry and Diana are perfect hosts. Diana Barnes believes that the bread of life tastes best when leavened with kindness, and it's the recipe for good business, too. Be generous to people, she added, and they'll always come back. Law Enforcement Polar Plunge Aids Special Olympics, Decatur. It was an overcast late winter day, but the sun burst through a half hour before the intrepid army of plungers began their annual ritual of freezing themselves to fund Special Olympics athletes. Dozens of high school students, teachers, and staff members were among the first groups to run into Lake Decatur after Police Chief Jim Getz began shooting off his starter's gun. The air temperature hovered above 44 degrees, with the water at 43, not quite as pain-inducing as during some previous events. This was the 15th Law Enforcement Torch Run Special Olympics Polar Plunge in Decatur, which drew 389 people of all ages to get wet for the athletes. The MacArthur High School Chili Mac team, sending plungers into the frigid deep for the third straight year, brought a group of about 30 students plus four teachers. History teacher Micah Bradshaw said this was the largest group the school has brought. It's about double of last year, Bradshaw said, adding that the group raised about $3,000. It's a great cause. This is one of the best things the community does. The Eisenhower Panthers team, which aced out its crosstown rivals for the most plungers recruited, was at the lakefront for its fourth straight year. Amanda Cedar, Eisenhower cheerleading coach, has been the chief organizer each year. We get really, really into it, she said of the team, which includes students who compete in Special Olympics. Eisenhower teaching assistant Corletta Murray was plunging for the 11th time. She previously went in with the Macon Resources Incorporated team, now known as MRI. She always tries to push herself to the limit, making it all the way across to where the Decatur Fire Department divers in dry suits form the far border. When kids tell me to jump in the lake, I say I will, Murray says. The Decatur Police Copsicles team included Brandon Watson, who joined the force in September, but he's not a stranger to freezing for a good cause. As an officer on the Hoffman Estates Department, he plunged a couple of times in Palatine. Watson planned to recover in time to work his regular second shift Saturday. The Baywatch beauties and beasts, decked out in red and white Southern California summer lifeguard uniforms, represented the Decatur Park District for the 9th year. I have an awesome group, said Dana Floyd, team leader, whose day job is special recreation supervisor. We're freezing for a reason. We have three Special Olympics athletes on my team. Team Acorn, fielding 11 plungers, raised about $3,000 in its first time participating in the event. That was good enough for second place in the 5-15 plunger fundraising category. The Dreamcatchers, a Special Olympics affiliated group, won first place overall in the 15 category, raising more than $5,000. Brittany Harding, Acorn team member, said it was an awesome event in which she also plans to participate in the future. "It's a bit painful, a little bit," she said with a chuckle, "but we were in and out quickly. It was a lot of fun." Joni Keyes, Special Olympics Area Director, said the event raised $82,000 thus far, with anticipated matching funds and other anticipated donations expected to help boost the total over the goal of $86,000. The Knights of Columbus, a Catholic fraternal service organization, also raises additional funds throughout the year for the group, which provides coaching and opportunities to participate in numerous sports for intellectually disabled people of all ages. "This pays for our entire yearly budget," Keyes said. Two employees of Archer Daniels Midland earned awards Saturday for individual fundraising. Shelley Benson raised $3,110. David Clover raised $1,865. "We were very fortunate with the weather today. No ice, no snow," Keyes said, adding, "The operation was aided by 60 volunteers and several sponsors. We didn't have to clear anything away. Everybody enjoyed themselves and had a good time. That's what it's all about." Decatur was the fourth city to hold a plunge in Illinois when its first event was held in 2002, 3 years after the first event was held in Lake Bluff. There are now 21 polar plunge events held statewide each year. In 2015, 7,666 Illinois plungers raised more than $2.25 million. Nancy Reagan, loyal protector of Harani, dies. Los Angeles. Nancy Reagan, the helpmate, backstage advisor, and fierce protector of Ronald Reagan in his journey from actor to president, and finally during his 10-year battle with Alzheimer's disease, has died. She was 94. The former First Lady died Sunday in her home at the Bel Air section of Los Angeles of congestive heart failure, Assistant Allison Borio told the Associated Press. Her best-known project as First Lady was the Just Say No campaign to help kids and teens stay off drugs. When she swept into the White House in 1981, the former Hollywood actress, partial to designer gowns and pricey china, was widely dismissed as a pre-feminist throwback, concerned only with fashion, decorating, and entertaining. By the time she moved out 8 years later, Mrs. Reagan was fending off accusations that she was a behind-the-scenes dragon lady, wielding unchecked power over the Reagan administration and doing it based on astrology to boot. All along, she maintained that her only mission was to back her Ronnie and strengthen his presidency. Mrs. Reagan carried that charge through the rest of her days. She served as a full-time caretaker as Alzheimer's melted away her husband's memory. After his death in June 2004, she dedicated herself to tending his legacy, especially at his presidential library in California, where he had served as governor. She also championed Alzheimer's patients, raising millions of dollars for research and breaking with fellow conservative Republicans to advocate for stem cell studies. Her dignity and perseverance in these post-White House roles helped smooth over the public's fickle perceptions of the former First Lady. The Reagans' mutual devotion over 52 years of marriage was legendary. They were forever holding hands. She watched his political speeches with a look of such steady adoration it was dubbed the gaze. He called her Mommy and penned a lifetime of gushing love notes. She saved these letters, published them as a book, and found them a comfort when he could no longer remember her. After Reagan was shot by John Hinckley just 3 months into his presidency, he was said to have famously wisecracked to her, "Honey, I forgot to duck." In announcing his Alzheimer's diagnosis in 1994, Reagan wrote, "I only wish there was some way I could spare Nancy from this painful experience." 10 years later, as his body lay in state in the U.S. Capitol, Mrs. Reagan caressed and gently kissed the flag-draped casket. In a statement Sunday, U.S. President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama spoke of the Reagan's journey with Alzheimer's disease. Later, in her long goodbye with President Reagan, she became a voice on behalf of families going through the depleting, aching reality of Alzheimer's and took on a new role as advocate on behalf of the treatments that hold the potential and promise to improve and save lives, the Obamas said. As the newly arrived First Lady, Mrs. Reagan raised more than $800,000 from private donors to redo the White House family quarters and to buy a $200,000 set of china bordered in red, her signature color. She was criticized for financing these pet projects with donations from millionaires who might seek influence with the government, and for accepting gifts and loans of dresses worth thousands of dollars from top designers. Her lavish lifestyle in the midst of a recession and with her husband's administration cutting spending on the needy inspired the mocking moniker Queen Nancy. But her admirers credited Mrs. Reagan with restoring grace and elegance to the White House after the austerity of the Carter years. Her substantial influence within the White House came to light slowly in her husband's second term. Although a feud between the First Lady and Chief of Staff Donald Reagan had spilled into the open, the president dismissed reports that it was his wife who got Reagan fired. The idea that she is involved in governmental decisions and so forth and all of this, and being a kind of dragon lady, there is nothing to that, a visibly angry Reagan assured reporters. But Mrs. Reagan herself and other insiders later confirmed her role in rounding up support for Reagan's ouster and persuading the president that it had to be done because of the Iran-Contra scandal that broke under Reagan's watch. She delved into policy issues, too. She urged Reagan to finally break his long silence on the AIDS crisis. She nudged him to publicly accept responsibility for the Arms for Hostages scandal, and she worked to buttress those advisors urging him to thaw U.S. relations with the Soviet Union over the objections of the administration's evil empire hawks. Near the end of Reagan's presidency, ex-Chief of Staff Reagan took his revenge with a memoir revealing that the First Lady routinely consulted a San Francisco astrologer to guide the president's schedule. Mrs. Reagan, who had a longtime interest in horoscopes, maintained that she used the astrologer's forecast only in hopes of predicting the safest times for her husband to venture out of the White House after the assassination attempt. Anne Frances Robbins, nicknamed Nancy, was born on July 9, 1921, in New York City. Her parents separated soon after she was born, and her mother, film and stage actress Edith Luckett, went on the road. Nancy was reared by an aunt until 1929, when her mother married Dr. Loyal Davis, a wealthy Chicago neurosurgeon who gave Nancy his name and a socialite's home. She majored in drama at Smith College and found stage work with the help of her mother's connections. In 1949, MGM signed a 5'4", doe-eyed brunette, Nancy Davis, to a movie contract. She was cast mostly as a loyal housewife and mother. She had a key role in The Next Voice You Hear, an unusual drama about a family that hears God's voice on the radio. In Donovan's Brain, she played the wife of a scientist possessed by a disembodied gray matter. She met Ronald Reagan in 1950 when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, and she was seeking help with a problem. Her name had been wrongly included on a published list of suspected communist sympathizers. They discussed it over dinner, and she later wrote that she realized on that first blind date, "He was everything that I wanted." They wed 2 years later, on March 4, 1952. Daughter Patty was born in October of that year, and son Ron followed in 1958. Reagan already had a daughter, Maureen, and an adopted son, Michael, from his marriage to actress Jane Wyman. Later, public spats and breaches with her grown children would become frequent source of embarrassment for Mrs. Reagan. She was thrust into the political life when her husband ran for California governor in 1966 and won. She founded a surprisingly rough business. "The movies were custard compared to politics," Mrs. Reagan said. McCarter sets town hall talk. Effingham. State Senator Kyle McCarter, R. Lebanon, is staging a town hall-style discussion in Effingham at 7 p.m. today as part of his primary campaign against U.S. Republican John Shimkus, R. Collinsville, in the 15th Congressional District. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. in the American Legion, Post 210 building at 201 Prospect Place. Shimkus has been invited to attend, either in person or by participating via Skype. McCarter says he will stage the event to hear about the issues. Whether Shimkus is there or not, a spokesperson for the congressman could not be reached Sunday afternoon to ask about his plans. McCarter said Monday's event will be live-streamed on YouTube and can be accessed from a link on his Facebook page. Coles County Health Department to close Mattoon office. Mattoon. The Coles County Health Department's Mattoon office will close this week because of budget problems. The services offered at the office at 1402 to 1404 Broadway Avenue will continue, but only at the department's main office in Charleston, Administrator Diana Stanger said. Stanger said the main reason for the decision to close the Mattoon office was the lack of state funding for the department. Specifically, the state owes the department about $169,000, mostly from the Illinois Department of Public Health, since the last state fiscal year ended in June, she said. The political standoff on a new budget has meant schools and other agencies haven't received their state funding for 8 months since. Stanger said the Mattoon office will be open through Tuesday. The office's current site opened in 2011, and the health department had a smaller office at a location on Charleston Avenue for 4 years before that. The office has the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Program for clients in the Mattoon area. The program helps with nutrition for pregnant women, women who are breastfeeding, infants, and children up to age 5. Immunizations and services in the department's Family Case Management Program also take place at the Mattoon location. The office's current caseload is about 450 people, and it has also provided immunizations for more than 100 since December, according to Brenda Warren, the department's WIC coordinator. Stanger said that the health department, board, and administrators ran several scenarios on how to deal with the funding reductions. The discussion to close the Mattoon office was based on staffing levels and the difficulty of the department would have paying the rent for the office, she said. Rent and utility costs for the office total about $20,000 each year, she added. She also said that other factors in the decision included that the department hasn't received a state grant to fund required services such as food inspections and disease control. Two WIC positions at the Mattoon offices were eliminated in August, Stanger said. There have been some other reductions, but no decision on any others, and the situation will be reevaluated this summer, she said. There are currently no plans to reopen the Mattoon office if the funding situation improves, Stanger said. We've used up our reserves, she said. We have to build up. Council considers funding for bridge work. Decatur. Work to restore the bridge that carries Mound Road over Spring Creek could begin later this year after a vote by the Decatur City Council. The council will consider on Monday an agreement to use federal and state money to pay for replacing deck beams on the bridge. Trucks weighing more than 22 tons have been restricted to using the bridge for several years after inspections revealed it was losing strength. Of course, that is one major route that we need to have a fully loaded truck to be able to go across, and that's up in our industrial area, Public Works Director Rick Marley said. We don't want to have load restrictions on that. As a result, it's necessary to go in and replace those deck beams. Construction costs are estimated at $915,000, of which $732,000 would come from federal funds. The city would allocate another $200,000 in state motor fuel tax money for the rest of the project. Work would begin in the spring after a state bid letting in April and is scheduled for completion by the end of the year. You know, there's a few things in Decatur that we are on top of in terms of infrastructure maintenance, Marley said. We've got some real problems with the pavements and other parts of the infrastructure, but bridges, we are on top of. We stay up with the bridges. You have to. In other business, the council is slated to consider selling land near Waspa Crossing to the Northeast Community Fund. The council would sell approximately 3 acres for $650, which would allow the organization to build a new facility more than twice as large as its current home at 825 North Water Street. The Northeast Fund provides thousands of families each month with food and financial assistance. City Manager Tim Gleason said other agreements to come before the council this spring could help develop a social services campus in the area, which already includes the Crossing Healthcare facility that opened in September. A3 Briefs for Monday. Decatur, Oasis Center threats. Police are looking for a 30-year-old Decatur man who threatened to burn down the Oasis Day Center, a facility which helps homeless people. Police reports describe a 57-year-old woman as being the victim of intimidation because of the threat, which was reported Friday. Decatur. Mueller fence damaged. A section of the fence surrounding the Mueller Water Products Incorporated plant at 1226 East Garfield Avenue was damaged by a hit-and-run driver, according to the police. The damage happened between 3 p.m. Friday and 6 a.m. Saturday when it was reported. A cost estimate for repairs was not listed in the reports. Forsyth. Library materials sale. A magazine and used materials sale will be 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Friday, March 11th, and 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, March 12th, in the Forsyth Public Library. Materials withdrawn from the library's collection for sale include DVDs for 50 cents, books for 25 cents, and magazines for 10 cents. Various items of the library furniture and decor no longer needed will be for sale. Proceeds from the sale will go to the Village of Forsyth's general fund. Mount Zion Kids Club Saturday. Mount Zion's Fletcher Park Kids Club will present Doodles Goes Country at 2 p.m. Saturday, March 12th at the Parks Recreation Center. The matinee, co-hosted by Doodles the Dragon, Granny Giggles, Princess Mallory, and Spunky Squirrel, is a special thank you to radio station WXFM 99.3 for its support of the children's program. Concessions will be available. Doors open at 1:30 p.m. Admission is $4 for adults and $1 for children. All proceeds will benefit the Fletcher Park Splash Pad Project. For more information, call 217-864-5424. Casey, Fire District Vote. A referendum asking voters to approve the creation of a Casey Fire Protection District is on the ballot for March 15th primary election. The Casey Fire Department plans to hold a public meeting on the referendum at 7 p.m. Wednesday at the fire station. Referendum organizers anticipate that the new district will levy an annual property tax seeking approximately $150,000 within its boundaries. Fire Chief Jason Garver said the levy for the district would result in the owner of a $100,000 home paying $115 more per year. Bosses blind to employees' change fatigue. Change, the adage goes, will never be slower than it is today. But as companies race to keep up with the breathless pace of technology and competition, many top leaders are not aware that it's draining their employees, according to a global survey published by Ketchum Change. In a survey of 500 leaders of large corporations in 7 countries, 3/4 reported the existence of change fatigue in their organizations, and 39% said it is highly prevalent. But perceptions vary depending on where respondents perched on the food chain. Just 28% of C-suite executives said change fatigue was highly prevalent in their organizations, compared to 41% at the director level and 47% at the senior vice president and vice president levels. The further away leaders are from the effects of change, the more blind they are to it and ill-prepared to mitigate the fallout, said Tyler Durnham, partner and president of Ketchum Change, a unit of global communications firm Ketchum that specializes in change management consulting. If they don't recognize that there's an exhausting impact that change and volatility has on their employees, they won't be prepared for its damaging effects, Durham said. Change fatigue happens when employees are so battered by change that they can no longer handle it productively. Burned out or apathetic, they foot drag, ignore, or destructively oppose change because they know they won't be able to adjust to today's change before tomorrow is making new demands on them, said the report. Or they quit. Ketchum identified 4 key attributes of organizations that thrive through change, chief among them transparency and clear human communication about the changes. The other attributes are being pioneering, such as by supporting the risk-taking, being dialed in, such as by creating strong connections with the internal and external stakeholders, and agility that lets organizations seize on the opportunities in real time. The most common impediment to effectively managing change is failure to gather input and ideas from employees across the business, according to the report, which was called the Liquid Change Study. Durham, who pointed to Airbnb and Uber as examples of pioneering companies that excel at change, divides companies into 3 categories that may give you flashbacks to physics class. Companies in the iceberg or solid state don't change fast enough and so are cautious about managing risk that they risk becoming obsolete. Gaseous state organizations are constantly moving rapidly toward the shiny penny, but employees don't feel that they have a confident, grounded strategy. The goal, he said, is to become a liquid state employer, which behaves more like a graceful river, maintaining strong common core beliefs, strategy, and vision as it moves toward new opportunity. Carter, cancer treatments end, Atlanta. Jimmy Carter announced Sunday that he no longer needs treatment for cancer, less than 7 months after revealing he had been diagnosed with melanoma that spread to his brain. Carter, 91, shared the news at one of his regular Sunday school classes at Maranatha Baptist Church in his hometown of Plains, Georgia. Carter always starts his lessons with a brief update on his recent activities. This week, Carter told the class he received an MRI lasting more than 2 hours. And then the doctors determined that I didn't need any more treatment, Carter said in a video posted by WXIA-TV. So I'm not going to have any more treatment. He smiled as the audience applauded. Carter spokeswoman Diana Congile said in an email Sunday that his doctors will continue to perform scans to ensure cancer cells have not returned, and Carter will resume treatment if necessary. A spokesman for Emory University's Winship Cancer Institute, where Carter has been treated, declined to comment on Sunday, citing patient privacy. All right, we're going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for March 7th. Please stay tuned.